This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
So you own a piece of land that's now underwater, basically. Is that right?
Right. The whole land is underwater. Our property, the inside part of the property, is about 50 feet out in the water. And I hauled the cottage in three times, the trailer, but then I had no more land, so I had to haul it up and I sold it.
That's Emmett McKenna, owner of what used to be a piece of land at the end of Savage Harbor Road on the north coast of Prince Edward Island. These days, his property line sits about 50 feet out into the ocean. Welcome to the first episode of The Coastal Citizen, an eight-part series where we explore the issues, challenges, and opportunities of life on the coast. I'm your host, Erica Butler. It's one of the facts of coastal life. Sands shift. So do rocks, earth, and even buildings built a little too close to the edge. Our rapidly changing climate is not only causing sea level to rise, but it's also bringing more powerful storms than ever before to our coasts, increasing flooding and washouts. On this episode of The Coastal Citizen, we look at coastal erosion. How fast is it happening? Where is it happening? And what are people doing about it? At this year's Coastal Zone Canada conference in Halifax, I sat down with Adam Fenech, the director of the Climate Research Lab at the University of Prince Edward Island. Adam had just finished demonstrating his Coastal Impacts Visualization Environment Tool, also known as CLIVE. I asked him to tell me more. Who is CLIVE?
CLIVE. CLIVE is essentially a video game, a serious video game, that inputs a lot of scientific data on the elevation on Prince Edward Island and how it might be impacted by sea level rise and coastal erosion.
So we're looking at an aerial view of PEI right now, and you can just sort of swoop in on any one spot and have a close look at what the coastline looks like?
Yeah, that's correct. The tool allows you to fly over the island, freeze at any point, and then using the triggers of a game controller, just slowly rise the sea level at increments of half a meter and see where the low-lying areas of Prince Edward Island are. We call this the raising the bathtub approach because it's essentially we just raise the water slowly. It's not a dynamic flow or a storm necessarily, but just if we raise the bathtub level, where the low-lying areas of Prince Edward Island are shown. And you can see quite quickly the island becomes three very quickly.
PEI becomes three islands.
Sorry, yes,
how many meters of sea level rise does that represent?
If you can see that with a 4 meter rise, it's starting to separate islands. Definitely we're on three islands now, and that's just at a 5 meter sea level rise. That's quite significant because even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change does not anticipate more than a 1 meter sea level rise in the next 70 to 100 years.
Okay, so it's a bit science fiction to see PEI turn into three islands. Now, this tool, this is your opportunity to show homeowners and show community members what will happen to their property or their communities. What is that like to sit down with someone and show them, you know, this projection, even just taking the 1 meter in sea level rise that we expect in by 2100?
Well, it's either a sense of relief if they see that the sea level is not approaching their property, or it's one of anxiety. There is something about the flow of water that really evokes emotion within humans. Especially if you're swamping the property that they own, but the intent is not to really scare people. The intent is to bring home a message of one: don't build infrastructure very close to the shoreline because the island is very erodible and it is very low lying, so very susceptible to sea level rise and coastal erosion. And also the other message is if you do happen to have a home or other a barn or what have you close to the shoreline, that you should be thinking about moving it further away from shoreline or in protecting it with some type of armoring of stone.
Can we go look at Charlottetown here for a minute?
Yes, sure.
Speaking of armoring or protecting the shoreline, you were showing us an example in Charlottetown of a community that has fortified their shoreline. And I guess my question with that is, we can see on the projection that it's working for them. But what happens to all the energy that would have eroded that coastline, and where does it go, and can we track that?
Well, normally when you do put some type of armoring, some seawall or some rock, armor rock, to protect yourself from the storm surges, the strength of the sea, it doesn't dissipate the energy. It just deflects the energy so that it goes somewhere else. And so for one way for us to look at the effects of what armoring the old community of Brighton, there's a lot of expensive homes that are right on the shoreline, and our tool Clive here does tell us that when we raise the sea levels, that there's no flooding until a certain rate.
Is anyone regulating how much one can fortify their shoreline? Like
on Prince Edward Island, you cannot armor your property without a permit. So in theory, it is being regulated by the province because you need a permit to throw stone or to build a seawall in front of your property. However, if you travel around Prince Edward Island, in practice, people have tried everything to try and stop the seas from encroaching on their property. I have seen old tires thrown into the water. I have seen old gravestones. I've seen almost industrial waste, garbage, construction waste. It's just that on Prince Edward Island, there's no natural stone, no natural hard stone. So they'll use almost anything, cars, old cars, to try and prevent the water from coming on shore. The concerns I have with engineered armoring are that it's very expensive, both in terms of design, because you need experts to design it, and in terms of the actual materials themselves, because we don't have the natural stone on Prince Edward Island. The cost is one thing, but also the replacement cost, because none of these armoring are expected to last more than 10 years. And when these millions of dollars are put in for seawalls around Prince Edward Island, and you go see them now at low tide, and they're just crumbling away. So it's a huge societal investment to continue to have to replace these types of protection, when perhaps retreat would be the better adaptation option. The idea, too, is that if there is this concentrated capital and only one person builds protection, it increases the energy and the erosion that happens right beside that one house that's protected.
Mm-hmm.
So one can't do it. You usually have to do many in a row. But again, it's expensive. It's probably cheaper to be to move into retreat. I don't know how many times we can keep rebuilding the same road until it makes sense to build another road altogether.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for showing me Clive and sharing your knowledge. Thank you.
Anytime.
So there's retreat and there's shoreline hardening. But there's also a movement to protect shorelines by mimicking the natural protections that we see along the coast. Emily LeGrand works at the Ecology Action Center in Halifax. She is scouting for a place in the region to create a demonstration living shoreline. The idea behind living shorelines is to slow down coastal erosion by recreating natural habitats in coastal systems that have inherent protective properties. I met up with Emily in Horseshoe Island Park on the Northwest Arm in Halifax. one of the sites considered for Emily's Living Shoreline demonstration. She gave me a tour of some of the erosion and protections in the tiny urban coastal park.
If we go along here, we can see some erosion happening up and behind the wall.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, look at this.
You gotta be careful where you walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We checked out a section of the historic seawall that has been washed out from behind, holding up what was now a gaping hole. Not only do waves crash over the wall and wash away soil, but stormwater runoff from the lawn and parking lot of the park also do their part. Unlike PEI, Nova Scotia has no shortage of rock, and we use that rock to protect against the rising tide. Emily's job is to help develop alternatives to the Nova Scotia toolkit to protect against erosion. I asked why she thought we needed alternatives beyond our rock approach.
So the reason that we are interested in expanding the options beyond rock walls, which are really what we're good at in Nova Scotia, we can see a lot just from right where we are that there's a lot of different sort of consequences to using them. So one sort of set of them has to do with how the coast normally moves and changes, and to do with the fact that erosion is a really important natural process that will happen and should happen anyway without human intervention. And the reason for that is that it unlocks the sediment that's actually really important in feeding or supplying beaches and mudflats and salt marshes, which are all beautiful and they're important habitat for a lot of different species. And they're also really protective for people and all this inland infrastructure, because they can absorb and buffer and act as a sponge for all that water and wave energy. So we need erosion, and that's probably the first thing that's important to this discussion and important to remember. Some other issues with rock walls are that they kind of, because they're a hard surface, they actually just reflect the wave energy and sort of point it in different directions, and it's not really easy to predict where that wave energy is going to go. And so it can have some unintended consequences for neighboring properties. So if our coast is divided up into all these little private chunks, and there's varying abilities in people's sort of financial capacity or decision-making to protect it in the same way, then you get this patchwork of rock wall here, not a rock wall there. And it actually moves the erosion just further down the coast. So if one person has a rock wall, chances are that their next-door neighbor will experience more severe erosion more quickly than they would have if the rock wall wasn't there.
Do we have rules about that? I mean, is there rules saying that if, you know, you can afford a rock wall, you might not necessarily be allowed to build one because it might affect your neighbors?
Right now, there's no rules about that. It's interesting to note that a lot of different coastal jurisdictions have, in the last 10 years or so, put in place laws against hard structures. So here, rock walls are really popular. In other places, bulkheads are really popular. But whatever the popular thing is, in many cases, there are rules against putting them in because of these issues about neighboring properties, and also just the coastal processes that we need. There's this recognition that if we put a hard structure in place, we're sort of locking that sediment in, and it can't sort of feed and be available to the rest of the coastal system. I think another important thing to think about with rock armoring and so on is it makes us question why we were drawn to the water in the first place. Often I think people are drawn to it because they want to be in the water, or they want to see a beautiful view of the water, or maybe they really appreciate seeing the wildlife that can use the water and the edges there. But if we have a pile of boulders, you know, do we feel comfortable having small children clamber over the boulders to get to the water? Do we really want to do it ourselves? Can foxes and so on feel comfortable doing that? Maybe, maybe not. And does it look as nice as it would have if it were natural? So by getting right up to the edge of the coastline and putting things that we care about right up at the edge, then we need to protect it and the only technique we have right now to protect it is rock armor, which again sort of peels back some of those reasons that we initially came to the water for.
Interesting. If we look at this spot on Horseshoe Island with this rock pile, this rock armor right here, what would it have looked like without that blasted rock that's been piled up there?
Yeah, so we can imagine that it would probably still have a little bit of a bluff, maybe a couple feet high, and then we'd have a beach, and we might have some salt marsh grasses in at the lower end of the beach toward into the water, or it might just be a sandy beach. But either way, we'd have a little bit of natural protection from either the salt marsh or the beach that might be there. And we might still have to think about erosion in terms of sort of where that bluff is located and how quickly it's losing material. But we could also recognize that it's feeding the beach that we're enjoying going down to and entering the water from. So we'd have a bit more access to the water and more creatures could get to the water as well. What's interesting walking along here is that we can see some coastal hardy vegetation coming in. There's a wild rose over there that's known for being really tough and having good deep roots. And that's something that we would explore as an alternative to having a rock wall there, saying, okay, if you've ever held a plant in a pot and it's root bound and you pull the plant out, does any of the soil come out? No, it's all locked in with those roots. And so that's really the value of having vegetation along the coast. The leaves and the stem and sort of the body of the plant protect that surface from wind and waves. And then down in the roots as well, that really binds the soil together and holds it in place. So if we're concerned about erosion, that's sort of step number one. Make sure you either have left the native vegetation in place, or if you haven't and you're working sort of more from this space that this park is, researching what plants will do well in a coastal salt spray environment and have those real deep roots and are native, and planting those in as you can. Some of the things that we've really been noticing are that people are actually doing things that accelerate their own erosion. And so at minimum, we'd love to be able to help coastal property owners stop adding to their own erosion.
Right.
And so the two main things that we see are people having lawns that they mow all the way to the edge and they clear that coastal vegetation that's really protective. And sort of along with that is the stormwater flows. To step back and say, where does water move over your property and what are its options to flow and to be absorbed and to both up into a plant and down into the ground? Those are all ways to intercept that water and sort of do something with it before it ends up picking up a lot of speed and flowing over your bank. Because sometimes when people have an eroding bank, if you look at it, you can see gullies in the bank, and that's from that overland rain runoff. And again, vegetation is really helpful for dealing with that as well.
Because it drinks it up?
Because it drinks it up, exactly, or pulls it down. Yeah. And I think there also needs to be greater public understanding of what naturalization is and why we're excited about it and why we're moving forward on it, because lawns are what we know right now, and with them we have, you know, space to walk around and not, you know, get brambles in our clothes and so on, and we can see for large distances and we can picnic wherever we want, and so I think people are pretty used to those things. So having a discussion about what all the other benefits and exciting things that would come from naturalization just aren't quite in a lot of people's minds yet.
You can also see a fair number of other, like, armoring across the way here.
Yeah.
The yep. Northwest Arm seems mostly armored.
Mostly armored. We can see from looking at all of these that there's no vegetated buffer. So they've removed any natural protection that they had, and now they have to put in the rock. So they would have spent money on clearing that land, and now they have to spend it again on holding it in place, whereas the vegetation would have held it in place. Erosion would still happen, of course, but at a slower rate than what they've sort of initiated with some of those actions.
Right, I guess that's an important point to consider.
Yeah, stopping it is not the goal. We shouldn't expect that to be the goal. We shouldn't look at a naturalized shoreline and say, it doesn't work because erosion is still happening. Mm-hmm. I think another key piece of this is that we need space from the coast for the coast to sort of do these functions for us. So if we haven't given it enough space to even erode a little bit, then how is it going to form a beach for us? So that's something that we need to keep in mind increasingly as we look at the effects of climate change and, you know, specifically sea level rise and increased storm events with the storm surge. We're going to need to give the coast even more space than we had. And there are sort of coastal legislation tools like setbacks and so on to help us do that. But right now in Nova Scotia, we don't have any of those comprehensively in place.
Emily and her colleagues at the Ecology Action Centre in Halifax have been lobbying for a Nova Scotia Coastal Act to create province-wide regulations that would govern things like shoreline hardening and other protections and prevent us from building too close to the edge. According to Jen Graham, coastal inhabitants could end up like Emmett McKenna, the PEI man who now has to swim 50 feet just to get to his property.
I think one of the big challenges facing us on the coast is that a lot of coastal property owners fall in love with the idea of living on the coast, but they have really no idea about any of the risks they face. They don't really know that the waterfront lot they just purchased for their dream home might be subject to storm surge, floods, or accelerated erosion. I think one of the big problems is that there's nobody in charge right now. There's no government department that looks at these applications for development on coastal lots and to make sure that they're actually suitable for the proposed use or to even tell people about some of the risks they might face by building their dream home on those lots. I think people are building as though this kind of stuff was something in the distant future. This isn't we'll have to worry about it in 100 years. We're facing these things now. The choices we make now have a lot to do with how livable, how safe, and how climate smart our city is.
Back at the Coastal Zone Canada Conference, I attended a talk by Hope Parnham, a landscape architect who worked for the City of Charlottetown back in 2012 when they were revamping their downtown waterfront plan. Hope was the Charlottetown rep for the Sea Change Project, a Canada to Caribbean collaboration aimed at improving community tools for climate change adaptation. During Hope's talk, she showed an email she had sent to a colleague, dated October 28, 2012. The email bemoaned the lack of public buy-in in Charlottetown to make the kind of changes that Hope thought were necessary to protect the city against flooding from sea level rise and storm surges. In short, Hope wasn't very hopeful. Then came October 29th.
The East Coast is being pummeled with the power of a record-breaking superstorm.
Oh my God, it's washing everything away!
90-mile-per-hour winds, driving rain, record-breaking high tides, and rough surf lash the coastline.
Superstorm Sandy wreaked havoc along the entire eastern seaboard, doing enough damage to make it the second most costly storm in U.S. history. The storm and the damage it caused became the major story in U.S. news media for weeks. For Hope and the Charlottetown planners vying to set regulations to protect against storm surges and flooding, it was convenient timing.
The storm was good timing for us in that it was 2 weeks prior to a large public meeting that had already been planned for the waterfront, and it gave the public a voice on their concerns about sea level rise issues and storm surge impacts, and gave us the push to make it regulation and policy within the new plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, Charlottetown and PEI in general had pretty strong effects from Juan.
Yes.
But
yeah.
That was almost enough in the memory that, I guess, Sandy is what was needed.
Yeah, and it wasn't that Sandy caused that much damage to Charlottetown. It was that it was on everyone's minds,
yeah,
and fresh in the media talking about impacts, the need to look at these areas in advance of the next big storm. When we look at projections for sea level rise, it often is so far into the future that it's easily ignored. It's generally outside the political time frame of you know, before the next election. So little is done from one council period to another. When we had that storm at the right time of adopting new development policies for the waterfront, we were able to bring those adaptation strategies into the regulations and the bylaw.
In its new waterfront plan, Charlottetown included an option for the city to buy up waterfront properties as they become available, set limits on residential development, and establish minimum elevations for finished floors in new buildings to be adjusted to match flood levels as they change over time. The approved regulations were a win for Hope and her colleagues, but she points out that they won't solve everything. The regulations don't apply to the seawall built around Charlottetown's brand new convention center, and they wouldn't have applied to Emmett McKenna's land out in Savage Harbor.
Do you think that there's any chance that you'll ever see that land again?
Not in my lifetime. It's too much of it gone. There was a big sand dune outside my cottage. It was over 50 feet high, and that was behind my cottage, and my property was inside that. That's all gone. All my property's gone. All the next property's gone, and three-quarters of the next property's gone. There's over 200 or 250 feet of land gone.
Jeez. Doesn't bode well for the future of PEI.
No, no. There's a lot of land gone on PEI in the last 25, 30 years. You wouldn't believe the land that's lost. The tide is coming in further, and of course, as it comes in, it's wearing it, then get a storm, and then it wears some more land, and it's coming higher all the time. I don't know what the answer is going to be, whether it's going to keep raising or not. If it is, there won't be much island left. It'll be all underwater.
That's all for this episode of The Coastal Citizen. Next week, we take a look at the oil and gas industry taking root off our shores and the concerns being raised about the risks and dangers it poses to our coastal communities. The Coastal Citizen is produced at CKDU-FM in Halifax with funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I've been your host, Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.